Welcome to Fusion International Film Festival's podcast.
Right, thanks for joining us. Today I've got the pleasure of chatting to Pamela Hunt, who's come up with this extraordinary feature documentary, The Search for Little Flanders. She is the writer, producer, director, kind of one-stop shop for this amazing piece. That's for our Fusion West Brussels edition. A quick synopsis, a community-produced feature documentary following the people of Langham, Pembrokeshire, as they unravel the little-known story of the Flemish takeover of South Pembrokeshire in 1105. Pamela, thank you for joining us and congratulations with your film.
Thank you.
So, you've got an amazing career. Can we just roll back before we start talking about this? You started the BBC, I believe, didn't you? Is that yours?
I did. I joined the BBC in 1969, right, just as television was going colour. And I joined as a trainee audio assistant, I think was the phrase or the title they gave us.
Yeah.
The princely salary of £1,189 a year.
I bet that was decent money then.
It was worth something then, yeah. My new boss said to me, he said, I'm going to put you on The Archers, he said. And there was I waiting to go into the telly studio to work in there, where they were producing All Creatures Great and Small and Spy Trap and shows like that. That's where I wanted to be. And I thought, The Archers, oh no, you know, this is definitely something I don't want to be on. But actually, he then said before we finished our chat, he said, you'll learn more about microphones and how to use them, doing sound effects on that show, than you will from any other possible source. And, you know, and I walked out thinking, oh, yeah, I'm sure that's true. But actually, he was right. Even today, I walk into a room, I note the acoustic, and I can decide exactly where I need to put a microphone for whatever purpose. And that includes miking up drum kits and musical instruments and things like that, you know.
And we should point out the sound, unsurprisingly, is coming through perfectly, as would be expected from you. And we should also point out that the sound on your film is excellent, as one would expect. So we know that it's...
Yeah, well, I'm still a bit of a fanatic for sound. I think it's a very important part of a film. I mean, everyone talks about the pictures and things like that, but they need both to tell the story.
Wasn't it George Lucas? It's either Lucas or Spielberg who famously said, people forget the sound is 50% of the experience.
Yeah, I'll go along with that.
So that's fair. That's a fair point. Okay. So anyway, I always like to have a little bit of background. So please, I know I've given the synopsis, and I'm actually got a still on screen here of the Bayeux Tapestry. But anyway, I digress. Which obviously from your film, just give us an idea of where this, how you became attached to this project, and what made you decide to make a documentary about it.
I retired. I worked in Wales. I've worked in Wales for the last, since 1980, I came back to Wales, having worked in Birmingham.
Yeah.
And I was brought up and educated in the west of England. And I knew nothing about the Welsh history. I mean, in fact, there's always been this little bit of the West Country people aren't that crazy about the Welsh and vice versa, just leave it like that. And apparently it dates back to the Monmouth Uprising, when Judge Jeffreys, who was a Welshman, came down and he was known as the Hanging Judge, and hanged all these people for getting involved in the uprising against James the First. So there's always been that little bit of bad feeling, I suppose. But I knew nothing about the early medieval history of Wales. I didn't know that there were three kingdoms and there were little principalities that made up Wales. The area I live in now was known as Dyfed, which it basically is Pembrokeshire, Carmarthenshire and Cardiganshire. And that was one of the biggest nations in Wales at the time. You've got Powys, that was another nation. Gwynedd was another one. I knew nothing about this, and I became totally intrigued about this whole thing. And, our vicar at the time, sadly, she died not that long ago now, but I got on very well with her. And we were talking about this sort of storyline and narrative. And she said to me once, she said, did you know, she said, you know, this was a Flemish village. And I said, well, yes, I'd figured that out, you know, from what I'd spoken to people about. She said, did you know that they were speaking Flemish from the time they arrived in the late 1090s, early 1100s? Mm. They were still speaking Flemish in the reign of Queen Elizabeth I.
Really? That's like some 350 years later.
400 years. That was the language of the era. Now, it was dying out because obviously, you know, the English language or the new, I think they call it Middle English, don't they? But that was taking over gradually. But it took that long for communities like Langham and others to adopt the lingua franca, for, I suppose, if that's the right description to give it. Anyway, and then I got talking to different people, including some experts who appear in our film, actually.
Yeah.
And I was just completely gobsmacked about this. You know, it. The more I dug, the more I realised that Wales has absolutely nothing to do with England whatsoever.
Well, hence the reason that I believe that, because I was fully convinced that if there was another referendum for Scottish independence, that Scotland would go. I'm not so convinced now. I think actually they wouldn't win. But anyway, I think that if they did win, I think Wales would go as well. I'm quite convinced.
I'm not supposed to be political on this, I'm sure, but I did. When the Brexit vote happened, the only party totally in favour, well, the Lib Dems were in favour of remaining, and the other party was the Welsh Nationalist Plaid Cymru. And I joined them. And I've never joined a political party in my life before. And in fact, if anything, my politics tended to be right-leaning, but very much to the left wing. I mean, I was in the what I would call the Kenneth Clark camp, I suppose.
Oh, yes, nothing wrong with Kenneth Clark. And who's the other one that Amber Rudd leaning?
Churchill's grandson also, he was on the left of the Tory
party. Yeah, that's quite interesting, isn't it? You wouldn't have thought that, but he was.
They were both picked.
Soames, wasn't it?
I was horrified that Boris kicked them out of the party.
I know, it was disgusting.
Absolutely horrified. I don't want to have any truck with a party that does that to some of its loyal members. Mm. So anyway, I joined Plaid, and it's fascinating to watch a tiny little party struggle to get money to get a candidate onto the voting list and that sort of thing. But remarkably, in the last Senedd election, the Welsh election, Plaid doubled its vote.
Mm.
And, you know, it still wasn't enough to take power, but they are far more influential now than they were a year ago.
Well, look what happened. Look where how the SNP started.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just don't know, do you?
It's all part of our interview.
It is. I love digressing like this. And it sort
but
of
anyway, moment. I loved the story. I mean, the story of Princess Nest, who was the princess, she was the daughter of the last king of Dehoybarth, who got killed by the Normans when they invaded in the reign of William II. I won't rattle this on too, because it's a history that in England you know nothing about, you've never heard of. But she was incredible. She was only four when she was captured, but she was brought up in a Norman household, a noble. They treated her as a princess. She had all those sort of privileges. She ends up marrying the son of the man who built Windsor Castle.
Really?
Gerald de Windsor. Gerald absolutely adored her. She was incredibly beautiful. And all the Norman nobles who came here initially all wanted, you know, they really wanted, dare I say this, get their leg over. It was, you know, she was incredibly beautiful, but they didn't touch her. No one, you know, she chose who she wanted to have a relationship with. She did end up having a relationship with Henry I, and which put her in great favor. In fact, she gave him a son who ended up being the Lord of Narberth, which is a town just up the road, castle still there. And she ended up, as I said, marrying Gerald, who died in the early 1130s. And she then married a man called Stephen de Morisco, who, funny enough, came from the town that I grew up in, which is Langport in Somerset.
Right.
He would have gone up the River Parret, out into the Bristol Channel, sailed down. And of course, you can imagine in those days, the Bristol Channel would have been like a motorway, trade going on between the two. And of course, down here in this part of the world, also trade with North Africa was quite easy to achieve. And obviously the continental, you know, France, Spain, and that sort of thing. So it was an area that benefited, I think, enormously from Flanders turning up here.
One of the things that interests me, and you kind of touched upon it in terms of unknown history, is when you think of the British Isles as a whole, all these tens of thousands of stories that are remain unearthed, because there must be so much, mustn't there, that we don't know.
Well, I mean, I remember watching, we did a S4C commissioned it with BBC Wales, and I think BBC 4 funded it as well, The Story of Wales. And Hugh Edwards was the narrator, well, presented it.
Who else?
That goes right. Oh, yeah, keep it in the family.
Yeah.
But it goes right back in time. It goes way back to, you know, before the Norman arrival. And I mean, this part of Wales, they lived under the laws of a man called Howel Dda, DDA or Dda. And women had equal rights to men when it came to property and everything like that.
Really?
You know, right up until 1093 when the Normans arrived. Blimey. I mean, the society here was far more egalitarian, if you like. And I found that intriguing.
What did the Welsh ever do for us? There you go. So.
Well, you're English, that's why. I'm honorary Welsh.
You know what I'm saying, is in, you know, you look back and think, you know, you can see that kind of progression. It's actually hard to believe that existed in that time, you know.
I know. It's been wiped out of the history books, you know. I mean, there's a big tragedy here. I'm getting political again now. But the Welsh government has decided not to teach Welsh history in schools. And I think that's tragic.
I'm sorry, the Welsh...
the Welsh government wants to keep to the regular curriculum. In other words, British history rather than Welsh history. I mean, obviously, they'll emphasise stories that involve Wales. I mean, like in Ashland Core and the Archers and the invention of the two-finger gesture.
Yeah, you know, isn't it?
The Dauphin threatened to chop the fingers off of all the Welsh archers.
Now,
after the battle... And of course, they were gesturing using their fingers.
I've heard this. I'd done archery. We had a go archery once in my own company, and we had the target set up. And I said to the guy, "It's really low. I didn't realise it was that low." And I said, "Is there a story to that?" And he said, "There. The reason it's that low, where the bullseye is because that's where the approximate place of the enemy's heart was." I said, "Well, they must have been very short." And he said, "Well, they were." Because in those days, people were a lot shorter. So you just don't know.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
They put things up.
Yeah, I mean, 4 foot 11, 5 foot 1, 5 foot 2 would have been tall.
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, you only have to go back to any. I've been to an Elizabethan house a few years ago, and I remember going to this winding staircase, and I was like, I'm over 6 foot, and I was crawling, and of course, because they were short, you know, they were vertically challenged, whatever you have to say, but that's just how it is.
The film, I mean, when we started making, I mean, I suppose we were chronicling it to start with, but I'm one of these people, we were talking about my career earlier on and how I moved on. Well, eventually I left the Beeb and started a production company called Raw Charm. I was intrigued by the history and that sort of thing. And I didn't get the opportunity to make many films myself because... If you're running a production company, you've got to go out there and get the next commission, and you can't go around playing with a camera. But what I did know about this project, or what we could add to this project, was the fact that the more volunteers you involve in something like this, the more opportunities people get to work in a different space or that sort of thing, the happier Heritage Lottery are. And so we had people making the tapestry. We had people involved in the archaeological dig at the site of the old medieval manor house, which is just outside the village, and that sort of thing. And I thought, well, you know, when it comes to people actually presenting on this film, why don't I just use local people who have got some experience? I mean, two of the presenters are retired teachers, and Graham, particularly Graham Stevens, he did a fantastic job.
No, they did. They did. I mean, the film's really well put together, and it's presented.
You know, as a presenter. But and Elizabeth, who did the narration, she'd never done anything like that in her life before. And we sat her down at the table in the next room, you know, blanket, thing like that, and put the mic there. And she's got a combination of a Pembroke show, but there's also a hint of Yorkshire. And I think one of her, either her mother or her father, was from there originally. And that's how she's got this hint of a Yorkshire accent. I think they visited Yorkshire a few times. But she did a fantastic job. And I was so impressed. And it wasn't a case of pushing her or anything like that. She just sat down and she read the article through. And the narrations through. I was in church one day and she was reading the lessons in the Bible. And I just thought, what a lovely voice she's got. And that's the sand person in me now. So that's how she ended up doing the narration. And we did the whole lot. In fact, I created spaces where I needed the narrations and wrote passages. And we got her to just read the whole lot. And I just dropped them into the file, you know, as an audio file at the time. But very impressed with her.
And did you, well, I suppose it's a double-barreled question. Did you put enough content in there? Did you wish you could add more? And also, what's your thought process behind cutting it to make it broadcast length? Because often they want 50 or 52 minutes, don't they, if it goes to that?
well, this one ran. Well, put it like this, Heather Payton, who acted as our exec, she's ex-BBC. She was involved in the World Service and Radio 4 in the news department. And I thought, I need a commissioning editor type of person to just come here, sit and watch the cut. You know, you get to a certain point when you need someone else to watch the cut. And I needed her to do that. And it was just like being in the presence of someone like Stuart Cosgrove when he was at Channel 4, you know, with the Nomad. And it was scribbling it. I think, oh God, what's she going to say? You know, and she had worked out about 30 minutes. Originally, it ran for 2 hours.
Right. Okay, that's too long.
2 hours, which is the director's go. It's far too long. Far too long. And you know, people who drove off to sleep in a film that long, if it's not interesting. And she suggested the cuts, and I fought to keep stuff in and things like that. I think there was one piece, I can't remember exactly what it was, but I did keep one bit. But she was dead right. It ended up being 90 minutes, right. 80 minutes, what's that, an hour and 20. And I felt that was a good length. It was allowed to breathe, where you did need to let your audience just have time to catch up with what they've been told so far. So I think that is important, to let a film like that breathe. No. And we had our lovely music group, La Volta, who I think they all retired now, but they play, they make their own instruments, you know, reproductions of early instruments like the viol, the crumb horn and all that sort of thing. And they play music from the 13th, 14th and 15th centuries.
Yeah, yeah.
We asked them to come up with some music tracks. We went down to a Roman Catholic church in Pembroke Dock and recorded that. And it was perfect. There were little bits there where I could easily isolate, a sort of 50-second sting or a 20-second sting that I could just put over a bit of pretty visual just to give people time to take breath and catch up with what was going to happen next.
And what will happen when you have to make what I would say is an inevitable cut if someone says, we want to broadcast it? Have you thought that far ahead?
No, because I don't think anyone would want to broadcast it, really.
You never know.
I don't know. I mean, we made it so we could put it on the DVD and flog the DVD to help raise money. Because, the money was A, to come up with this story, but also to restore the church here. It is medieval. It was built in, the original Welsh churches believe it was built around 700, 750, but the hence the name Llangwm, which is church in the valley.
Right, okay.
And so sorry, a brain melting. And I do apologise. You'll cut all this out, won't you? And let me just get my act together, because this is interesting. Oh God, this is horrible. This is what happens when you get old, Steve.
Older.
All right then. What was I saying again? Can you just remind me
about the church, the medieval church?
Yeah, it built in 700. The church as you see it today, although it's probably been rebuilt over the centuries, but it is the same shape as it would have been when Adam de la Roche, who was the grandson of Godbert the Fleming, who is believed to be the man who settled here in 1120. He rebuilt the church. And basically, what is the chancel today was the Welsh church at that time. And the nave was the bit built on and that sort of thing. And then in 1350, they built the side chapel, which is where now the tapestry lives and everything like that. And we installed Wi-Fi in the church so that people could watch. We created some short films, one in Welsh, one in English, one in Flemish.
Yeah.
Narrated supposedly by a character called Mabel, wife of Hugh the Fleming, who actually existed. They found a document in one of the houses they were renovating in Haverford West. And it refers to there, this was a deal on the rental of some land for the price of an iron needle for stitching. And it was Hugh the Fleming and his wife, Mabel. So we decided we'll bring Mabel back to life and she can tell the story. But we did that in English, Welsh and Flemish. So that, people, if you like, the three languages most interested in the narrative.
And after this, is there anything new you're looking at, or
with back pain and stuff like that, I'm beginning to think I'm too old for it. But if something appeals, I might start tinkering and coming, dreaming up how it might work.
Trouble is,
Heritage Loft loved the project.
Well, the trouble I've spoken to lots of documentary filmmakers. A lot of them have said that they found the biggest problem wasn't the making of the film, it was the research that took the time.
Because it took years,
in some cases.
Yeah. Well, this is it. And it's, I love telling, I suppose I do love the historical side of things. I pitched a lot of programs or series and programs which sort of involve film archive and that sort of thing. So, so you've got plenty of background imagery that you can use. We did a very successful little series called War Stories, which was broadcast on BBC Two Digital in Wales back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And we just went around interviewing people who had been involved in a conflict in one way or another. We decided it was just as many women as men. Who had a 5-minute story to tell. And this was sort of when their schedule brought them back to join the network. It was a little 5-minute film. And, we had some lovely stories. We had two characters from the First World War, one who was a pilot in the Royal Flying Corps, and another was a foot soldier who was training on swords. We did a series about swords. We met him. We used part of an interview that he did for us on that within the War Stories. But we came right up to date. We had, people telling stories of their time in Bosnia and that sort of thing. Fortunately, not Iraq and Afghanistan. But, it was nice to get them. But there were some lovely stories. One woman who joined the Wrens during the war. And it was her escape from the apron strings of her family that she also insisted she wanted to go abroad. So they sent her to Ceylon, now called Sri Lanka, isn't it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And a lovely little lady who worked at the aircraft factory in North Wales, Hawarden, building Wellington bombers, which were made with wooden plywood and cloth.
Yeah, that's
and she stitched the wings.
Right. Incredible.
And I just thought, and there was some lovely footage. A Canadian film unit had been funded to come and make a film at the 24. It was known as the 24-hour bomber, and it was a bomber that had basically everyone involved in the making of it did it for nothing, and all the parts were supplied by the various outsourced manufacturers for nothing, and they completed this one aircraft in 24 hours from scratch. And it went off to join a squadron somewhere or another, it was a lovely story and she was part of that. And it was lovely that they felt they could trust us and tell their stories. And one of the things we found was that there was one character who had never spoken to his family about what he went through. He was obviously suffering from PTSD and was still suffering from PTSD. And I always keep in touch with the people that we talk to in these sort of instances, because I'm not one of those producers who like to say, well, thank you very much, bye-bye.
Well, yeah.
You know, you've got to make sure they're all right. But this guy, it helped him. His family watched the program go out, and then he felt he could talk to them.
Oh, right. Oh, lovely.
If you would like to submit to one of our festivals,